Today I'd like to talk about something that I grouped under the term collective intelligence. And the idea is to focus on tools that help usually large group of people to put together their knowledge or their capabilities in a way that wouldn't be possible without the help of computers and networks. So we're going to talk about online communities, social media, recommender systems, crowdsourcing. The last item, in fact, is not just privacy, it's general issues around these types of systems. So here's the slides, by the way. So I'm going to keep one set here, because I have notes. So the notion of collective intelligence is something that is being used in various contexts. It's generally the idea that a form of intelligence can emerge from a set of cooperating entities. And so it's used not only when we talk about humans cooperation, but more generally. In fact, the term was introduced by Emil Durkheim, who created sociobiology, including at the biological level, how individuals organize themselves. And so it goes from ant colonies to groups of humans. And the idea is that this form of intelligence emerges from both collaboration and competition among the various individuals. So there are some quotes that you keep reading when you start looking into that area. The whole is more than the sum of the parts. And another one that is also very frequent is the wisdom of the crowd. The idea that a crowd of people is less likely to be wrong than any individual. So as I said, the term first came in sociobiology studies, and in fact inventing the field of sociobiology, because a lot of biology is really focusing on individual individuals or even parts of individuals. And now this term is used all over the place in politics, economics, computer science, and particularly CSCW, especially with all the tools that have emerged recently, such as social networks and social media. So this notion that computers could make us collectively more intelligent, more able to do things, is not new. It was, and I already talked about Doug Engelbart in both the intro class and earlier in this class, but it was really his dream of having computers augment human intellect, and he always envisioned that this would be a collection of computers plus collections of humans working together and solving problems too big for any one computer or any one human. Now, the idea is not just traceable back to Engelbart. You can go back a bit further in time to, in the context of computers, to Vannevar Bush, who wrote this piece called As We May Think, as you may remember, invented but never built this machine called the Memex. And again, the idea is that by essentially externalizing in the computer a number of our knowledge and giving access to this to groups of users, we could empower them. And there are others also that have written on this. A lot of the work that was done around hypertext, Ted Nelson's Xanadu, the idea was by creating this network of information and making it accessible to groups of users, you could really leverage the intelligence or knowledge of each of the actors and build bigger things. So what computers introduced that was new was this ability, and it was not just computers and networks, was the idea that you could support larger scales of collective intelligence than had ever been done before. Because until then, people had to either be together in the same location. The reason, for example, that conferences were invented in the scientific field, for many, many years, science was mostly an individual affair. If you look at the great scientists, you know, Newton or Pasteur or others, I mean, of course, they had a group of people, but they were mostly individual. And one person could have all the knowledge necessary to, you know, make progress in their own head. It's not true anymore today. People work in larger groups, and they work in international networks. And so the reason scientific conferences were created, it was really to get a bunch of scientists together so they could use their collective intelligence. And you had to put them together in the same site, and because a lot of science was funded by, you know, various, what's the word in English? Mecen, people who had money to fund the scientists. The conferences lasted a long time. I mean, you know, today when I say I go to a conference, I'm going to be away for 3 days. When seven mathematicians or physicists convened a conference in Paris, it could last 2 months. I don't know if you know the story that led to standardizing the meter. Right? So the reason there was a need to standardize the meter was that there were all sorts of different units all across France and the world, but even in France there were hundreds of different units, and it was becoming an impediment to doing business, that everybody were measuring things in different ways. And so they decided we have to standardize one unit for everyone. And of course, they couldn't pick any one of the existing ones because it would make some people unhappy. And at the time, because of the scientific movements, they wanted to create a unit that was based in something that is sort of part of nature. And so they decided that the meter should be the 20,000th part of the meridian between the North Pole and the equator. So it would be a measure based on something natural. And so what they did is they send two, I don't know if you say geometers in English, géomètres, people whose job is to measure terrain. And they went from Dunkerque, which is in the north of France, all the way to Barcelona. There are two cities that are on the same, roughly, meridian. And they took the task of measuring the distance between Dunkerque and Barcelona. And that was without GPS, you see what I mean? And so the way they did this is by triangulation. And so they took two guys not working together, working independently, so they would have two independent measures and be able to see the differences and decide what to do about it. And the way, of course, we don't have a pen today, or maybe here. So the way they start in Dunkerque, and essentially they go to the top of, I don't know, the highest building out there, and there's another guy in their team who goes to another place that is visible by sight, and then they have devices to measure the distance when they can see each other, and then they do a triangulation of that sort, where they So by having these triangles, they can minimize errors. Because of course, each measure is going to be a bit wrong, and then they can sort of combine those measures, and they did this by foot all the way from Dunkirk to Barcelona. Now there's a fascinating book written about this, where it explains how they cheated, how they made errors, how they corrected errors. And when they were getting close to Barcelona, the society that had sponsored this adventure, really, decided to convene in Paris to wait for the results and pronounce the meter is going to be this long. And they came in Paris, and the results were not coming in, and then there were conflicting results, and then they were adjusted. I think they stayed there for 4 months until they had enough data that they could make a decision. Anyway, this is a long detour to talk about this notion of collective intelligence, where you had all these smart people, you know, having to come to Paris to stay there for 7 months, discussing night and day about, you know, how to solve this problem. And of course, what computers allow you to do today is to do this while staying at the distance to some extent, or, and I think it is as important, and oftentimes people don't realize that, it's also, it allows you to travel and to go to a place without really leaving home. So, you know, when I go to a conference, or when I go visit the lab, I can still work, for example, with my students here or my group here, by being at the distance. So the thing is, all these technologies don't replace being face to face, but they make it easier to do things at the distance. So what we'll see is the different categories of tools that have been developed over the years to enable this kind of large scale collective activities. From large scale mediated communication, so we'll talk, you know, things like chat rooms and the tools that were built in the 80s and 90s. More sophisticated mediated communication, like we have with social media today. I'm not going to talk about MOOCs unless you ask me. Do you know what MOOCs are?
No.
No? Well, then you should ask them.
What is MOOCs?
Ah, thank you. I'm glad you asked. So, MOOCs, it's massive online. Now I don't know what it is. Massive online course. Massive online courses. I don't know what the acronym is. Really. So, it's a thing that has been a wave over all of higher education, where it was started by people at Stanford. Well, it really started with several universities, but the most well-known one was MIT, which decided a few years back to start a project called OpenCourseWare, where all the course material from many of MIT courses were put on a website available for everyone. So you could go there and find, you know, slides and references and videos and things for courses taught at MIT. And at the time, it was seen kind of a revolution, because the idea was that, you know, to get to see what is being taught at MIT, you have to be an MIT student. And so putting this out to the world was quite a wild idea. A few years later, and seeing that, you know, this was working pretty well, but never really you know, picked up large amounts of users. So there were two professors at Stanford who created an online course where they recorded videos, so 10 to 15 minutes videos for each class. And they had online questionnaires to do multiple choice questionnaires, so the students could test themselves. And they announced announced this to the world, and they got 160,000 people registering for the course, which was free. And so for the duration of the course, they every week they put out a new video and a new set of exercises and etc. And for the, as you know, I spent the last 2 years at Stanford. You couldn't have a 5-minute conversation without it shifting to the subject of MOOCs, because it's seen as something that is going to completely change the way higher education, at least, and maybe also high school level education is going to be done. And so what's interesting about MOOCs is that the concept was created by someone who had a very different idea of how you could really have a large crowd of students distributed all over the world to take part in a class. And the original idea was really a social network where people, the students, would be sort of linked together, and there were a bunch of features to help them to work together as, you know, cooperating students or advisors or etc. The way it's been taken by these Stanford professors was a very reduced set of features. You have a video a week, some reading material, and this online testing. And now, these two professors each have created their own startup. And one is called Coursera, the other is Udacity. And what they're starting is to enroll a bunch of other universities to create courses that they put online. And their business model is that you can register and participate, attend the course for free. In the end, if you want something that sort of testifies that you took the class, that's when you have to pay. And this thing has taken so quickly that you have a number of universities. I was reading something scary the other day where there are universities that are now considering that students should take some part of their courses, even students who are on campus, who have, you know, paid in the US, you know, it can be tens of thousands of dollars to be there, should take some of their classes, some of their courses with this approach to save costs. Because of course, you know, you record the videos and then everything else more or less is automatic. So, so it's a case where the technology really is making possible distributing videos to a large number of people, having this large scale online testing and these kind of things. So it's not just, you know, a chat room and sort of simple conversational tools. It's a set of tools to enable this kind of collective activity. Now I think all of this is nice and interesting, but I think what gets really interesting is when you get to what I call hybrid computational models, where in these systems the computers are fairly passive. I mean, apart from hooking people together and you know, moving messages around, there is no algorithmic complexity really, or rather the content of the communication is not really analyzed and processed by the computer. So when you get to things like recommender systems or crowdsourcing, there you have the real power of the computer, which is to do computation and to run algorithms on data sort of provided or created by the users. You combine that with the ability of the users to create and do what I will call human intelligent tasks, and combine the machine intelligence with human intelligence. So let's start with at the beginning. And the beginning is the notion of online communities. Now, as I've said before, humans are really wired for communication. We are social animals, and every time you create a technology, if it enables broadcast medium, and became successful as a person-to-person communication device. The text messaging on GSM phones was not something designed originally for people to send messages to each other. It was more for engineers to communicate. And when people, you know, when they made it available to users, they did not predict that it would become so big because it's so limited. Twitter, which is, you know, something that forces you to limit what you say to 150 characters, has had a tremendous success. So even in a world where you have many other means to communicate. So anytime you have a technology that lets people communicate, they will use it in a way you didn't anticipate. Now, a lot of the things like the telephone or the SMS are for person-to-person communication. I mean, yes, or even email. Yes, you can do, you know, you can send me an SMS to several people, but it's really more successful as person-to-person technology. Since the 70s, a number of systems were developed to support group communication and also the archiving of what was being communicated. Because if you make a phone call, if you send an SMS, if you send an email, it's either gone after the communication takes place, or it may be stored on your own personal computer, but there's no central repository where the different participants can come back and see what happened. So bulletin board systems were created, the first one according to fairly quick research on my part was in 1978, and certainly in the 80s and up to the 90s, up until really the web took over, you had zillions of online systems that you could access in various ways, depending on the technologies that were available at the time, again, before the web. And what these systems provided were the ability to chat, so person-to-person chat, but what was most successful was the notion of multi-chat rooms. The ability to share information and documents, so the ability to put documents, to record the conversations in the chat rooms in a place where if you come back later you could find them again. And some of these were using things like email. So there was when I was a PhD student myself in the early 80s, the big thing was the network news. And every day we started the day by reading the news, which were coming over 1200 baud connection from I don't know which other server. And these were organized in interest groups. So, you know, you had really anything and everything. If you were as a computer scientist, if you were working on some topic, if you were using some system from some programming language, you would have one, usually several network groups, net news groups about this. Net news still exists today, so people use it, but I'm sure you don't. Sorry?
I am.
You are, okay, well, that's good.
But for some topics, like mostly hacker related things, because for other topics, web forums are better.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, and the web forums are the modern version of this, really. But the number of we're using online message boards where you literally log into a service. And in the 80s in France, the Minitel was a big vector of the systems. The Minitel was originally designed first as a way to put the paper phone book online and save the telecom, which was a public service at the time, to send them money. And you know, once you put the database accessible online, they figured out they could get access to other services as well. And they did something very clever, which is that anybody could easily put out a service on the Minitel. And the way you did this is you buy a computer, you bought a few modems so people could get to your server, but all the accounting and all the billing was done by the telephone companies. And telephone companies are probably the companies that are the best in the world to do accounting. You know, they charge you by the second. So, you know, this is probably using more of their computing resources than the networking itself. But anyway, so it was very clever because first it meant you didn't have, you didn't have to have advertising. The downside is you paid for communication, you paid by time, and that could get very expensive. But in the context at the time, it made sense to have something like the telephone where you paid by the time you stay connected. But what was very clever was to make it possible for people to put out services only having to deal with the technical skills of putting the service together and not having to deal with the billing. And what happened is, although the plan was to have a number of services available online, which were essentially access to databases, you know, I remember at the time, oh, the other thing is that the terminal was given for free. If you agreed to not receive the paper phone book anymore, you got the terminal for free. And so, so the idea is that the services that people would develop would be access to, you know, information that is available online. So I remember, for example, using a service that gave you real-time information about the flights. This is something that you guys, you know, take for granted, that you have to go to the to pick up a friend at the airport, you log in to see when the plane is landing. I mean, until the Minitel, you couldn't know. I mean, there was no, you could try to call the airport, but chances of going through were pretty low. And here you could go online and have real-time information about the flights. However, the thing they did not anticipate is the success of the Minitel would be brought by message boards and chat systems. Now, a large section of those were what was called the messagerie rose. And Xavier Niel, who's the head of Free, made money on this, loads of money. But a lot of things in there were message boards and chat services for topics other than sex. And that's again a case where nobody saw that coming. Nobody anticipated that what people would want to do with this device is get in touch with each other rather than go and look at some kind of online database. So what you find is these online communities is a combination of systems that are some real-time, like the chat rooms, some asynchronous, and they support direct communication, but these communications in general are archived, so you can get back to them. And they also support sharing of documents, sharing of documents. Multi-user games also were quite popular, and even on the crude terminal, the Minitel that you just saw, there were games that developed very early on that were using multi-user games. And in the 90s, you'll find a number of studies of people who have looked at how the systems were used really for building communities of people with shared interests at a scale that was never seen before, even though at the time, because the technology to access the servers was you know, usually limited to a country. If you were in France, you'd be using the Minitel, but nobody outside of France would have access to the Minitel. If you were in the US, there were some services like AOL became one of the big ones. But if you're not in the US for many years, you wouldn't be able to use AOL. And even if you could, you probably wouldn't, because you would have to pay for the cost of a phone call to the US. So even though it was still limited at sort of country-wide communities, it was allowing people to create communities at a scale that had never been seen before. And a number of studies were done to see how people use these systems. And you know, one of the things that came out of this work is that you have this sort of life cycle of the user of an online community, where in the beginning you are what's called a lurker, where you know you are in the periphery of the community. You stand in the back, you watch, you see what's happening, but you don't really engage or participate, etc. Then you decide to step in, and you are a novice, discovering not only the way the system works technically, but also the untold rules of, you know, what is okay to do and not okay to do, what is called the netiquette. So you know what the etiquette is, right? So, and that's fascinating, because the systems are really a combination of a technology, oftentimes simple or even crude, and this set of social rules of how the community works. And I mean, if you go to, I don't know how things have evolved, because I don't have time for these things, but if you go into chat rooms, I mean, there were really a level of social control of kicking someone out if someone is talking too much or being, you know, unreasonable or doing things that are seen as not appropriate for the particular topic. So going from novice to a regular user is this process of learning how to be part of the community. And to be part of the community and be accepted, you have to contribute. I mean, if you see all these web forums today, it's very different, because all these forums are open to everyone. You find them by Googling. So the cost of entry is much lower. And so, you know, you have, I don't know, you have a prime, you find a forum, you ask a question, you wait for an answer, and then you got them. I think the culture that was developed in these online communities, where, you know, the value of the community is that you can ask a question and people will answer you, but that only works if people answer. And so if you ask questions, you should also answer questions for which you are competent. And that sort of traces the way from novice to regular to a leader, to someone who has gathered social recognition as being a person who is either, you know, wise or has a lot of knowledge that they can, they're happy to share with others and things like this. And then, you know, as I'm sure you know, with the social networks, for example, this can take a lot of time. And community building, whether it's in the real world, I mean, if you're engaged in an association or do something as a volunteer, it can really, you know, eat a lot of time and eat your life. And so at some point, the point where you say, well, you know, I want to step out of this and take it easy. And this is what they call, in some papers, going from leader to elder, where you sort of step out. And next week you'll have a class by Wendy looking at talking about ethnography and the social science that goes with groupware and CSW. And I think this community, this is the interesting part. It's not the technology itself, although it's always interesting to see how technical features enable or discourage certain types of behavior and certain kinds of user innovation. But the thing that is fascinating is to see how people organize themselves in these communities by never meeting with each other, never really knowing each other, and having this sort of parallel life to their
life in the physical world.
So then what happened in the mid-90s is the woman that started to become popular. Now, the story of the World Wide Web as an online community is actually quite interesting. I mean, I'm sure you know that originally it was designed to address the needs of a very particular community, the people working on high-energy physics. And the problem was that this community was spread all over the world. They had a few places like CERN, like Fermilab, a couple others that were big labs with this big equipment. And to create this big equipment in the first place, to run experiments on this big equipment, required collaborations at a scale never seen in science before. Literally, if you look at the NHC today, the Large Hadron Collider, it's thousands and thousands of people who have worked oftentimes for over 10 years, 15 years on this project. Now, in the 90s, the I don't know exactly when it started, but I know the LHC took about 15 years from planning to actually starting using it. And so the problem they had is, even though, I mean, scientists and academia in general has been using the network probably longer than anybody else. The internet was created by DARPA, and the first users were really academia in North America, and then it spread very quickly around the world. I mean, I started here in 1982, and we had access to the whole world through the internet. I mean, it was not very fast and reliable, but it worked. And so even though those scientists had access to this, they didn't have a good way to share the documents. And so what Tim Berners-Lee and Robert Caillot did was to first create this hypertext system based on a few very simple principles. In fact, what you have in the World Wide Web is much, much simpler than what at the time was being discussed as hypertext systems. And in a sense, it's both the reason for the success of the web, and it's also, in my opinion, the curse of the web, that it's so limited. So you have one type of link, and links are unidirectional. And you know, you talk to any people working in hypertext, it's insane. But from the perspective of the community building, the imposing or having people use the World Wide Web was not as easy as you may think. A lot of people didn't like the ideas, and Tim Berners-Lee is, you know, recognized as the creator of the World Wide Web, but it would not have happened without Robert Caillot, who was the manager who did all the work in the back to convince the management at CERN in the first place and then beyond to support the system, to use it, and to deploy it. Now, the thing is, from the start, the web was a way to support a particular community who needed to share and update documents. And so the first browser that Tim Berners-Lee created on the next computer, I mean, it was actually not the first browser he created, but the first one, you know, using really the basic principles that we still have today, was a browser designed not only to browse, to look at documents and to navigate from document to document, but you could also author documents in there. And again, that's the key. If you want an online community to work, you need to have tools to take stuff from the community, and you need to have tools to give stuff to the community. And so he created this editor where if you had the access right to the server where the document came from, you could edit your document right there in the browser. You didn't have to go and write HTML files and upload them by FTP or God knows what. It was directly embedded in the browser. And I think I told this story before, but the original browser was developed on the Next computer, which was the computer built by the company Steve Jobs created when he left Apple. And it was a not commercial success. And so someone decided to create a browser that would run on the X Windows system, which was more successful, especially in the academic world. And that person was Mark Anderson, and he created Mosaic. And he created the browser, and he never had the time to add the authoring part. And to me, it's something absolutely amazing that still today, a browser is only a browser. And as we will see, it's taken over 15 years to put back in the browser what was there in the first place, and to put it in a way that technologically is insane, where in the page that you load, you also load a bunch of JavaScript that includes the authoring capabilities for that page. I mean, how many, versions of comments, text editor, or a thing to enter a blog post, or something to pick a date in the calendar, or something to have menu systems, have been pulled every time each out of the web when they could be right there in the browser and be done in a consistent way and with better usability. And what's interesting, I think, in this process is the rise of the web was just astonishing. And the reason is because the situation before was complete fragmentation. I mean, you had AOL, you had BBS, you had all these online services in France, everything with the Minitel, was going through the Minitel, but you had to go to those different services. There was no directory, there was no easy way to find things. And at the time where the web started to get known outside of this original community, there were still competing systems. I mean, I remember we had Gopher, we had there was another one, and we had the web. And it was not clear who was going to win. And the reason the web won is because at the same time it was based on, as I said, very simple sort of technical principles, which made it easy to create web servers to host content, which made it easy to also write clients. And it was also very flexible, so it could accommodate many different types of content. And in fact, fairly early on, and I think it's Netscape that first integrated the programming language in there, was JavaScript. And that was, I would say, around 93, 94. So really, when the web started to get out of the academic community and into the real world. And so very early on, it had this ability to put programs inside pages. And it's through this means, and I think, again, it's an interesting case of user appropriation of technology. There was a strong push to move from static pages to pages that were computed dynamically. So that was the thing happening server-side, where you didn't have to have all of the pages in HTML. You could generate that on the fly. And on the client side, you had this notion that content was also interactive beyond the basic things of clicking to go to the next link. Forms were created very early on. And then with JavaScript, you could make interactive things happen inside the client. And so what you have today is, I think the web has, in a sense, maybe forked into at least three different things. You still have the idea of, you know, I go to a site and I look at static content that is there. Then you have all the e-commerce stuff, which is essentially a database with a front end for querying and finding things. And then you have all what people have called Web 2.0, where the interaction is richer, and this is what we call web applications. And I think the power of the web is to be able to sort of host this very different things inside the same type of set of protocols and standards. And speaking of online communities, again, very quickly, the tool was adapted to support things that it didn't support in the first place. So in, I didn't put the date, I think it's, 94. So 94, again, 94, the web is really still, it's getting fairly well-known inside the academic community. It's almost unknown outside of it. You start, you know, big companies start having their websites and this and that, but people at home don't use it. And the primary reason is because they don't have good enough network access and cheap enough network access to use it. And of course, the development of computer networks accessible from everywhere was really pushed by the web. So in 94, Ward Cunningham invented the wiki. Do you know why it's called the wiki?
Yes. It's a Polynesian one?
Yes. So it's the thing, it says wiki.
We're going fast, I think.
Yes, so wiki in Hawaiian, Polynesian, is go fast. So it's the name of a shuttle bus in Hawaii. And I guess Ward Cunningham went to Hawaii and liked the name. So it has nothing to do with really what the wiki is, except maybe that the goal was, from early on, really Tim Berners, the idea was to turn every reader into a potential author and publisher of information. And the web, as it had turned, with the browsers being only browser and not authoring tools, made it difficult to be an author to contribute. You had to have special access rights, you had to have different tools to edit the pages, you had to have ways to upload stuff. And so with the wiki, the idea is to make the cycle of editing a page, modifying it, updating it, making it available, a lot shorter. And so what it did, it was a Perl script that was using a form where you could edit the content of the page, and when you click submit, it would update the database, and next time you go to the page, you would see the new content. So, as often, something very simple, and the original wiki, which he created for the community of researchers working on software patterns, it was called the Portland Pattern Repository. The original wiki still exists, and that's how it looked like. And then wikis developed really like a fire, and there were many, many different wikis because creating one was also fairly easy. In fact, in 97, 98, I went to spend 2 years in Denmark, and I wanted to use the wiki, and somehow it didn't make his code freely available, and I'm to say I don't quite know why, and a lot of people were unhappy about this. And so what happened is that a lot of people recreated, of course, the system, and they all put in their own tweaks and changes. And so in 97 that I created the wiki myself because I couldn't get his software, and I wanted to use it for the project I was working on, and so I wrote one in a couple of months.
which in fact is still in use today in a number of places.
And of course, the most well-known success of this approach to doing sort of online shared community creating a body of documents is Wikipedia. So this is numbers I found yesterday. If you type in Wikipedia statistics, there's a page on Wikipedia about the statistics of Wikipedia, as there should. So currently it has over 4 million articles in the English version of the online encyclopedia. It has 18 million users. I wanted to write how many languages were supported, but it's probably 100 or 200 languages. There's about 125,000 active users per month, which I thought was pretty low. That people who edit different users editing a page on Wikipedia. And they, not that long ago, they break the barrier of 1 billion edits in the pages. And of course, we know Wikipedia. In fact, if you Google for something, the Wikipedia page is often going to be very high on the list. But it's only it's a big part of an iceberg, where there's Wikibooks, Wikiversity, MediaWiki, which is the software that you can use and is used in many places to host local wikis, Wikinews, etc. So this concept of having online information that is created by a community has been very successful, and there's nothing really in the history of mankind that is comparable to this. Now, of course, with Wikipedia and the notion that you have something open to everyone has its problems. And what is interesting is to look at the social structure that goes with something like this. Because, on the one hand, there's this discourse that says, it's open, you can do it, you can do, what you want, but we assume you're good people and you're not going to do stupid things. But over the years, the amount of both technology and human engineering, in a sense, that's been done to control what's going on and to make sure that the quality of the content is not degrading is astonishing. So you have many robots that crawl the pages all the time and fix things or add links. Every time there's a robot, every time it sees a date, it links that page to each date in the calendar has a page on Wikipedia. But they also have things that check for information. They have tools that give them heat maps of pages that are heavily edited. And then there's this whole hierarchy of Wikipedians who have varying levels of power, including the power of blocking a page because it's being messed up with, or things like this. Which then raises issues. I mean, it's open, but it seems to be more open for some than for other people. And of course, there's the issue of how do you trust the information in Wikipedia. And there have been studies that have compared the quality of the content in Wikipedia with things like Encyclopedia Britannica. And of course, depending on what you look at and you measure things, some people will find that Wikipedia is better, and some will find that Britannica is better. I don't think it's the right question to ask. I think what is missing in Wikipedia is, although it is improving, is having better ways to figure out if you should trust the information. So, I'm sure you've seen many pages that have
banners that say, you know, this page is missing references, or this page seems to have a biased perspective on this or that. And some of this is done by automatic tools, other is done by users themselves flagging it. Some is done only by those who have the right to put some of these banners. But we had a project in the lab a few years ago where we were looking at the patterns of use of pages. Just, you know, displaying on a page how many times it's been edited in the past month, 6 months, year. So getting feedback about the activity on a particular page, and you know, we found that it helped people feel more or less confident about the content.
So there are many studies of the not only the use of Wikipedia, but I think more interestingly, the social structure that has built over the years to support something like this. Yes?
Could you have a page on Wikipedia?
I'm sorry?
I think you have a page on Wikipedia.
Yes. Yeah. Which I didn't create nor edit.
It's part of the netiquette, you're not supposed to edit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading yesterday.
They did this thing, was it this morning in the paper? They did the statistics of how many people have a page on Wikipedia compared to the population. And they interpreted this as the number of famous people. I mean, as if you have to be famous to be on Wikipedia. I mean, anybody can, you know, you just ask a friend of yours to create a page for you. I mean, that, you have to have something to say on the page. So I thought this is, but I think this is very interesting to see how this notion of, and I'll talk about it in a minute, about social networks, but how, you know, the notion of recognition or fame or notoriety is transformed when you have tools like this.
What I do like about Wikipedia is
the people who, sort of this social structure that is in the back with the Wikipedians, people who do lots of edits, spend a lot of time they're not interested in being recognized. They have recognition inside their community, but they're not, you know, trying to put their name on the every page they edit to show, you know, to get tokens or to have some kind of fame outside thing. And that's, I think, a good thing about the way this works, which is very different, of course, from what we'll talk in a second, which are social media. I realize the time is running, so maybe, I think this is a good point to take a break. And so we'll go from Wikipedia to blogs to social media to social network, and then to recommender systems and crowdsourcing. So let's be back at 11, that is 15 minutes.